the staff to realize what JMB was whispering. You know what was whispering to me?
Steve, you're wonderful. Yeah.
After a few more years, it was sort of...
Steve, you're all right.
Yeah. And a few more years after that, it was sort of like, well,
Steve, maybe it's not that bad after all, you know.
But the message changed, but it continued to kick my ass every time until it kicked my ass in here. Anyway, I don't know how I got off on that, but this is my home group. It's one of them. What was the next statistic? Oh, I also have not one, but two sponsors. If you're new, you can have as many sponsors as you want, you know. In fact, I've been sober, if you did the math, like 29 years, and I still sometimes think that two isn't enough. Like maybe I need to be the first guy with a committee of sponsors. I can imagine them having a meeting once a week to discuss my case, you know. All right, Alec, this week I want you to take resentments. Shelley, I want you to take guilt. Bob, I want you to take relationships. Oh, again? I don't know. But my sponsors are Shelley Norwood from San Pedro and Alec Fakeney, who's down in the desert. And one of the advantages of having two sponsors, if you're an alcoholic like me and you get a little twisted up, there's often times that you'll want a second opinion, right? Just in case you don't like the first one. Yeah. But unfortunately, I can't predict them. I actually have one sponsor who's successfully divorced and one sponsor who stayed married for 45 years. You know, and I figure I got it all covered, you know, because I move around a lot in that department, you know. I just actually a year and a half ago was at the beginning of a very, very painful divorce. It's over now. And at that particular point in my life, I wanted to hear somebody tell me, yeah, hang in there, you know, stay the course. So I called my sponsor that was successfully married for 45 years. I called him up and I told him the whole story. And here's the kind of wisdom I get from my sponsors. I'm waiting for him to say, yeah, stay the course, hang in there, Steve, and everything. He just simply said, Steve, maybe God's doing for you what you can't do for yourself. And that was the end of it. My sponsors, neither of them give me advice. And that's something I saw in a sponsor. If you're new, you genuinely are the most important people in this room. If I get around to it at the end of the pitch, I'll tell you why, but it's not just because you're here as a bad example to remind us what it used to be like. Maybe I should get into it now, but I think that we live a program of spiritual action made possible by seeing this program work in other people's lives, because I lose track of this of the fact that it works. I came here with my lights off, man. My lights were off, and I think the pilot light was like flickering a little bit. And after several months of diligently working this program, the lights came back on. But you know what? Sometimes they get pretty dim again. And there is nothing that will restore my faith in this program faster than seeing a newcomer with the lights going on. You know, there is nothing as fulfilling or beautiful to see as that, and nothing that will reinvigorate my program more than that stark miracle of seeing the program work. But if you're new and you're feeling like I felt, what Faye was talking about, dry mouth, man. I came to my first AA meeting, and there was like this little automatic pilot up here or something that was making my dry mouth talk and my sweaty hand, sticking my sweaty hand out. You know, oh, okay, you're glad I'm here. Well, then I guess I'm glad I'm here. Oh, all right, you want me to come back? Well, I'll come back. And meanwhile, there was this other center down in my gut that was just like screaming with every nerve end that it could, mistake, mistake, abort, you know. And part of being an alcoholic for me is that there's not a very good communication connection between here and here, so the message fortunately didn't get back to my brain. But if you're new and you're feeling that way, if you're feeling like you're not sure what the deal is here or whether you belong here, I'll just tell you that my working definition of Alcoholics Anonymous is this is the biggest non-organization in the world, made up exclusively of people who didn't want to join. You know, there's just, it's not, I mean, think of it. Anybody remember back to their high school when they had career day or job fairs or stuff? Was there an AA booth there? You know, I don't think so. This is somebody there to tell you, oh, yeah, you might make a pretty good alcoholic, you know. But none of us comes here and wants to be here or wants to stay here. For most of us, this is the last stop on the block. That's just the plain fact of it. I had to exhaust all other possibilities before I came here. For you newcomers, I have a mixture, I guess, of bad and good news for you. The bad news is that if you're here, it's probably not a mistake, you know, really, because it is the last stop on the block for all of us. And I came here, and I still wanted to think. My thing up to the end, I don't know why I thought it was a preferable diagnosis, but I thought I was just badly neurotic. And that I happened to have a form of neurosis that was completely and totally relieved by variable doses of alcohol, which I know now is sort of a good functioning definition of an alcoholic. But I really didn't know if I belonged here. And I didn't know whether alcohol was the problem or whether I was the problem or what. It's a very confusing thing when we come in here. The bad news, good news, good bad news, or bad good news, I don't know which way to put it, is that if you're here and you are like me, you have a disease. I say good bad news, that was good news for me, because the alternative was that I was a spineless degenerate with absolutely no control of my life, so a disease sort of sounded good by the time you guys convinced me, you know. But it did take a lot of convincing. But if you're new, we have a disease that is as well understood, perhaps, as leukemia or diabetes or a lot of other diseases. When you inject alcohol in our blood, different things appear in the blood than they do in non-alcoholics. Frightening to me as a parent of two grown daughters is if you inject alcohol in the blood of our children who have never been exposed to alcohol, different things appear in their blood. Our brain waves react differently to alcohol. If you look in the fluid that is in our spine or our brains, we're a little short on those happy hormones that everybody else gets. In fact, if you look real closely, we're shorter than depressed people. You know, I mean, we don't have enough of those happy hormones. And recently, with last year, all this chromosome studies and everything, it looks like we have this problem that's on chromosome 1, sort of genetic. And I think we deserve to be on 1, you know. The bad news about that is that you aren't going to go get no new chromosomes, you know. We're sort of stuck with it. So I should probably, in all fairness, give you some good news. The good news is, even though this is a disease that leads almost inevitably to death or insanity and a lot of other tragedies in our life, there is a cure, not a cure, but a treatment that will put this disease in remission one day at a time for the rest of your life. That's pretty good news. If I was coming here with diabetes or leukemia, I would probably think that was very good news. When I came here with alcoholism, it didn't sound like such good news to me. And that's the real bad news. The real bad news, even though that treatment is out there, only about 10 or 20% of us alcoholics get it. And many, many more are exposed to it, and they don't get the treatment because they don't think they need it, you know, and they die. They just flat die. It's the number one cause of death, you know, in my considered opinion. And that's because the most important part of our disease is something called denial. And I believe that denial is what the book is talking about in the part that we just read tonight that says being restored to sanity. I think that the insanity it's talking about, there's only one word for it, is that incredible denial, which and alcoholics is of a psychotic proportion. We really are out of touch with reality when it comes to alcohol. A lot of people have denial. I was just down at a meeting in the desert, and a guy had a heart attack. The ambulance came, took him out during the break, and took him away. But a lot of people want to think that chest pain's heartburn, you know. And you know what? If that denial can kill somebody with a heart attack if they keep listening to it. But the truth is, if a heart attack victim gets rid of their denial, guess what? They still got a heart attack. If we got rid of our denial, there would not be a disease of alcoholism. There'd be a real lot of really very neurotic people running around with no place to go, but they would not be dying of alcoholism. That's just the plain truth of it. And that denial is my biggest enemy today, as much as it was the day I walked in here, you know. I spent 15 years of my life waking up every morning with that voice in my head saying, and this is the first phase of denial we go through, this time it's going to be different, right? This time it's going to be different. After a while it was worse, you know, it could get worse, but it was different, you know. And if we are lucky enough to finally overcome that stage of denial, as I did, and I finally came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I looked around me in that meeting, and that voice just did a little switch on me, and it said, you know what, Steve? Maybe you're different. You know? So we come in here, and most of us, I think, get past the denial of the disease. I think most of us get to a point of acknowledging that we have a problem. It took me a long time to do that. But then I think where we get hung up is we deny that we need the solution, we underestimate how much solution we need, and that's a reflection of that same insanity. There was a guy, I got sober at South Bay, and there was a guy about 2 years ahead of me, took his birthday about the same time I did. He'd get up every year, and he seemed so together compared to me, because he said the same thing every day. He'd say, I came to AA, and I looked around, and I said, if it looked like a duck, talked like a duck, and quacked like a duck, probably was a duck, and I've been here ever since, and blah, blah, blah. And I just don't relate to that kind of thinking at all. You know, for me, it's more like if it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, walks like a duck, and thinks that it's an American eagle, it's probably an alcoholic duck. You know? And the problem is, I've had spells throughout my career in AA where I've become an eagle again. You know? We have to remember that that's part of the insanity. I went Saturday and visited somebody with over 30 years that had a slip. You know, and at the end of chapter 3, the last line in chapter, or the last sentence in chapter 3 says, does it not, once again, the chronic alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. That except in rare cases, and I haven't seen one, the alcoholic or another human being cannot mount such a defense, that defense must come from a high power greater than ourselves. It doesn't say in there that we have no mental defense during our first year or our first 10 years or our first 15 years or our first 30 years. We have no mental defense. And I have trouble keeping that in touch with that. I have no problem knowing that I'm here under a state of grace. I got here through a state of grace, but I forget that I stay here in a state of grace. And that insanity can come back at any time. And the mistake we make is we see somebody going out, we think the disease came back when they picked up that drink. It didn't come back when he picked up that drink. It came back weeks or months before when that voice in the head came back and said, maybe you're different. Maybe you don't need to call the sponsor. Maybe you don't need to call your sponsor. And then we start doing the things that we always talk about. But it's the insanity, and the book says that the disease of alcoholism centers in the brain. I believe I had the allergy from the very beginning, but it says in the book that the allergy is pointless and academic. I didn't understand that allergy. I took my first drink when I was 18. I'm always in awe when I look around this room and I know that there are people that were done by the time they were 18. But this is a while ago, and I took my first drink when I was 18, and that was followed by maybe 2 minutes of social drinking. My idea of social drinking for the next 15 years was when two or more people passed out together. That's what I thought social drinking was. I had no concept whatsoever of social drinking. And I never did. Actually, I'm sort of grateful for that. I don't think I'll ever go out in that manner, because I wouldn't cross the living room to the kitchen to get two beers. It's not something I've ever experienced, and it's not something that would remotely interest me. I drank pharmacologically from the beginning. And I did that for 15 years, you know, I couldn't understand why I couldn't drink enough to just get right there. You all know where right there is. Or it would be a childishly simple task, one would think, to fill a vodka glass up to right there, if you're a guy like me, and drink just that much and stop. I tried it on numerous occasions, but I couldn't do it. It was really bewildering to me when that happened. Actually, I had to come here. I actually studied it. I looked it up. We didn't have internet back then, but I had resources to study it, and I could not figure out why I couldn't do that. Somebody pointed me when I got here to the doctor's opinion in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it explains right there, better than I think any text written about alcoholism since that was written, that we have an allergy of the body that explains the fact that we can't do that. Wouldn't it be nice if that's all that the disease of alcoholism involved was, just a little allergy? You go down to the Red Cross, get one of those little bracelets, maybe with a snake and a shot glass on it. It says on the back, if found comatose, please do not administer alcohol. The truth is, I probably have 20 or 30 friends and acquaintances that are allergic to penicillin, and not one of them, to my knowledge, sneaks off at night to Penicillin Anonymous meetings, you know? Not one of them keeps a little Petri dish out in the trunk of his car where the wife can't see it because he can go out and have a little snort of the old mold when she's not looking. In fact, if someone is allergic to penicillin and breaks out, you would have to hold a gun to their head. I know this pretty much, to get them to take more penicillin. And yet, it's not that absurd, is it? It's not more absurd than the jaywalker analogy in the book. We are insane. It's like a person that's taking something that breaks out over and over again and keeps taking it over and over again. And good doctor explains that, too. He does tell me that the disease centers in the mind, that the allergy would be pointless and academic if we did not take the first drink. And in point of fact, we take the first drink. We read about that at some meetings, too. And when we read chapter 3, it tells us right there, because we have an obsession of the mind. An obsession is not with alcohol. Obsession is with an idea, the idea that someday, some way, we will control and enjoy our drinking. And I was able to control it at times at the beginning, and I was able to enjoy it, but I couldn't do the two at once, ever, ever, not once in my entire drinking career. So I spent 15 years with J&B and then wine, and my life got worse. I was totally bewildered by that whole evolution of my alcoholism as it progressed. I had absolutely no comprehension of what was going on. I think I understand a little bit the obsession and the denial. I believe that it has, as the good doctor says in the chapter again, that we alcoholics drink mostly because we like the effect produced by alcohol. And I believe that I experienced alcohol differently than any non-alcoholic I've ever talked to. I'll probably date myself, that there's a comedian named Lenny Bruce that many of you young people probably never heard, that sounded sacrilegious when he died of a heroin overdose, or morphine or something. But someone asked him one time what it was like to shoot heroin. And he just looked him in the eye and he said, it's like kissing God. And that sounds sacrilegious, but as a recovering alcoholic, when I heard that, that fully registered with me, because alcohol did something profound for me. It did something so profound that at some unconscious, sub-visceral level, the idea of giving up alcohol was like giving up oxygen for me. And I didn't know it, because I don't think that was a conscious thing. And I think that's where that incredible psychotic denial came from. So I just kept drinking until it beat me into the ground. And I can't tell you what's different from the last drink from the drink before. It's not a rational thing that gets us in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I do like to say when I'm at the podium that I took a lot of other pharmaceuticals. I actually sometimes jokingly say I was the Will Rogers of pharmaceuticals. I never met one that I didn't love. And I think we should, in spite of what you hear at me, I think if you're about to go out and smoke some non-habit-forming marijuana, or you're about to go out to take some Ativan or Vicodin or many of the other good things out there, I suggest you go to your home group, perhaps your discussion group, and you bring it up. Because that's the number one cause of slips that I see today, is those other little drugs that we're not supposed to discuss here. And in fact, I have trouble with all of them. I had trouble with all of them. I couldn't control any of them, and that's the nature of our ailment. I can't take aspirin properly today. I had a request for what happens when I take aspirin, because some people have heard what happens when I take aspirin. But I'll come home from work with a little bit of a headache, right? I maybe worked a little too long, and I have some medical education, not to mention a great deal of common sense, and I know what to do for a little headache. I go to the medicine cabinet. I get out the aspirin bottle. Now, the label says 2 aspirin for the average adult male. This leads me to the instant conclusion that the proper dose for me is 3, you know. And before those 3 aspirin have even had time to dissolve, I know they're not working. And I take 2 more, you know. And the cunning thing about when we get into the chemicals, because the person that slipped this weekend, this is what happened, that I was talking to him, is our thinking seems to be borne out. It seems like 5 was just the right dose, because my headache goes right away. My head feels wonderful, and it's probably an hour or two when, for no reason that I can put my finger on, I realize I've got a little bit of an upset stomach. Now, with all my medical education, not to mention just plain common sense, I know what's for upset stomach. I go to the cabin, I get out some Maalox or Melanta. Now, if you took 2 aspirin, maybe an ounce of Maalox. If you took 5 aspirin, baby, we're talking 2 or 3 ounces of Maalox. And I put that stuff down, and it's miraculous. Within a short period of time, my stomach feels better than when it started, you know. And in fact, it's probably several hours before, for no reason I can put my finger on, I realize that I'm having a little bit of diarrhea. Yeah. Now, with all my medical education, not to mention just plain common sense, I know what to do for a common trotch. You know, I go to the medicine cabinet, I get out the K-Apectate. Now, if you took an ounce of Maalox, well, you know the thinking. I take 4 ounces of that K-Apectate. And within an hour, it feels like there hasn't been any traffic down there for weeks. And in fact, it's probably the next morning before I'm in the bathroom on the throne, realizing that I'm a little bit constipated. And I'm sitting in there sort of straining at stool, and it gives me an intense headache. Two weeks later, I can't get more than 20 feet away from the bathroom, and it all started with a little headache that would have got better if I rested myself a little bit. See, I really wasn't addicted to alcohol or phenobarbital. I have a friend that used to say anything at all. I was addicted to comfort. And when I went off this stuff, things started to hurt. And they started to hurt real bad. And that's why it made it so hard to stop. That's why our recovery depends on this lucid moment, this sort of intangible surrender that we have to all go through. It's not something you can go home and do. I used to love that early meetings when some guy would come and poke me in the chest and say, you got to surrender. Man, I go home and try. But if I had a sword, I'd give it to somebody. I didn't know what to do. But it's not something... If it's not something that you can bring on yourself, it's something that only happens to you two ways. God gives it to you, or more alcohol gives it to you, and that's just some way God's way of giving it to you, you know. I had something happen to me in sobriety that always reminds me of the irrational process of that last drink. What happens to it? I was actually several years sober. And I don't want to discourage anybody that's new, but for the first 8 years of my sobriety, I had severe periods of really bad depression. Couldn't eat, couldn't sleep. I was very unhappy. That ended my 8th year. Since when, I'm happy to say I've been unhappy when the occasion calls for it, but I haven't been in a depression, you know. And I discovered a couple things in my 8th year of sobriety. The first thing I discovered was a strange paradox that you don't have to believe in God to be benefited by prayer. I became so desperately unhappy my 8th year of sobriety that for the first time, believe it or not, in my sobriety, I prayed. I don't believe I prayed in any organized sense before that. And I just learned the prayers in the book, and I learned them by rote, and that's still my prayers today. And I am today, still, some days, an agnostic who is strangely benefited by prayer. This God deal is like a radio station that I can't quite keep tuned in. You know, that's just how it is for me. The second thing I learned is the only thing I don't think is in the book, the only thing I would change about the book, and that is that physical exercise has a profound effect on my emotions. But I didn't do that anymore with moderation than I do anything else. I'm an excessive person, you know. Actually, my downfall is if there's anything besides a spiritual way to make me feel good, anything out there that makes me feel good, I'll do it until it feels bad. That's just the way it is. And I was zealous about this exercise. I went skydiving. I took up wind sailing. I ran a marathon. I mean, that was like a one-time deal. I broke my leg running a marathon. I just broke. I didn't fall. It just broke. You know? I took up all kind. Even now, I'm sort of, you know. But the end result is that I have a little magnet on my refrigerator that says inside every old person is a young person wondering how he got there, you know. And I have I'm 62 now, and I'm taking up kiteboarding right now, and I just finished learning wakeboarding, and I've got this 62-year-old head that says, you can do this, and I've got various extremities that say, want to bet, you know. And the story that I'm leading up to is I was 8 years sober, and I took up roller skating. They didn't have rollerblades then, and I did it with typical alcoholic zeal. I didn't even rent a pair or anything. I bought the most expensive pair I could find. And I go out and I buy all the family skates, and we're going up to San Francisco on a vacation, and I lugged a duffel bag full of skates. Nobody else wanted to skate on a vacation in San Francisco. We go up to Golden Gate Park, and we come down there, and there's a path going down into the park that appealed to me for a couple reasons. The first reason is it had the same incline as the parking structure in my garage where I learned to skate, where I practiced at home. My daughters subsequently told me that I needed not only an orthopedist, but an ophthalmologist, because this was not a gentle slope. But at first glance, and I hardly ever take second glances, this looked like the incline in my garage, which made it tempting. What made it irresistible was the large white letters across the top that said, "No roller skating." And those hadn't even had time to register on my brain, and I'm in the path, and I'm going down that path. And for the first 100 yards or so, I got what I always sought in these things out here. I felt free. I got that sense of freedom that I think you all, some people nodding their head, you know what I mean. I felt that sense of freedom. And then after that first 100 yards, at a point of which I was going faster than I've ever been going out of an automobile, I had to learn a lesson that I've learned over and over and over again, before sobriety, in sobriety, and that is that there is this fine line between being free and being out of control. My life is flashing before my eyes. I come out of the bottom of that. The other thing I learned, I realize I'm going down there, my life's flashing before my eyes. I realize there's one facet of roller skate training that I haven't brushed up on, how to stop. I stop right on my wrist, It was badly fractured. They sent me back up for surgery. The anesthesiologist, fortunately, I knew the guy, and he did what a good doctor should. He explained all the options to me. Amazingly, I elected not to be put out, and we used this thing called regional anesthesia, and he explained the whole thing. "Steve, we're going to put this blood pressure cuff in your arm. We're going to shut it off so none of the blood can get out. We're going to inject some lidocaine in your vein down and fill your whole arm up with lidocaine, and you won't feel anything, but you'll be wide awake." He says, "I just want to warn you, when we take that tourniquet off, all that lidocaine, 100 times, 1,000 times more than we put in a tooth, is going to rush up through your arm, through your heart, and up into your brain." Well, I was liking the sounds of this already, And he says, "Moreover, when it gets up in your brain, you might get some ringing in your ears." Well, if this guy should only know the trouble I've been through to get stuff in my brain, a little ringing. I said, "Fine, no problem." And it went just as he said. They were pounding nails. I could hear it. Takes the blood pressure cuff off, the lidocaine rushes up my arm, into my brains, and what I want to share with you, we do not react normally to chemicals. I have never been so stoned in my life. And I learned subsequently this is a reaction that can occur with this medication. But I'll tell you how stoned I was. They're wheeling me on this table on wheels, this gurney, back to the recovery room, and I have a couple realizations in rapid succession. The first is that I'm having no trouble with ringing in my ears, but I'm blind. Now, I'm not talking like when you used to drive on the freeway, you cover one eye, makes it a little better. I'm talking black curtain. All right? That was my first realization. The second realization was that I didn't particularly give a shit. Even though I didn't much care, I spoke out into the darkness around me. I said, "Mike, are you there?" And he said, "Of course I'm here." And I said, "Well, I've got a bulletin for you. You told me my ears might ring, but you didn't mention a thing about my vision. I'm blind. Is that gonna last very long?" And there was this sort of long pause out in the darkness out there. And this voice comes back to me from the darkness and says, "Steve, your eyes are closed." I thought about that for a long minute. I opened my eyes and my blindness was cured. But you know what? My spiritual eye, we have this expression around AA, don't we? We hear when we're ready to hear. We see when we're ready to see. And my spiritual eyes were no different. How many times my sponsor and numerous other AAs tried to open my eyes to the beauty and simplicity of life around me, and I just couldn't see. And they opened, finally they just opened up. I had another, and they closed periodically. Mine closed, have been this last year, and it's been terrible, year and a half for me. And only the last few weeks have those eyes opened up again, and they're just opened up again. I think we're all at risk when those periods of time, when those eyes close again. Any one of us can go down during those times. If you're new, I've got about 3 minutes just to tell you, please, please, please stay. Somehow, I think my advice to you is to take your head out of the loop. Just Listen to anybody else. I had to get a sponsor when I got here because this is a very painful process. My sponsor wouldn't listen to me very much, I thought. I had a lot of real problems when I came to AA, and he didn't want to hear about it.